Welcome to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On, clinical sexologist, and Xander Kegg, licensed clinical social worker. We have a short announcement to make. The views and opinions expressed by guests on the Umbrella Hour are theirs and theirs alone, and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Umbrella Hour's hosts or co-hosts or any of its officials. The information covering health and mental health care is for informational purposes only, and does not replace your providers, such as your doctors, your psychiatrists, whomever cares for you. It does not replace the treatment you receive from them or the care from them. You'll be hearing this from now on with every show. In the meantime, Xander will introduce our guest this hour.
Yes, I will. Thank you so much, On. Hello, everybody. Our guest today is Logan Berrien. Logan has a bachelor's in health sciences. He's also a registered nurse and has a certification as a case manager. He currently works as a complex medical case manager, a researcher, and director of transgender surgery at the Bunky Clinic in San Francisco, California. Logan's been serving the trans community as a trainer of other medical providers in trans competent care, in aiding countless patients in informed consent and navigation through the gender-affirming surgery process, and co-authoring, data collecting, and publishing groundbreaking patient-centered research on outcomes in phalloplasty and metoidioplasty in transmasculine communities. You can listen to the Progress podcast series on surgery preparation at https://pod.link, and then it has some numbers after it. It's 165-2577729. Again, pod.link/165-2577729. You can also find Logan on LinkedIn. Welcome to the show, Logan.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. So I was trying to remember when we met. So I was trying to remember, I know for sure we knew each other in 2014, because that's when we met around within the FTM community who were having post-surgical complications with bottom surgery. And one of our previous interviews was with myself and two other gentlemen who were all talking about our bottom surgery experiences. So they can go back and listen to that. I was trying to remember if we knew each other from before then, but maybe not. Can you remember?
I actually was, it's so funny, like on my way back to my place so that we could record this, I was thinking about the same thing. And I think we actually met sometime between 2006 and 2008. I used to do a group at the community center that was on Howard and 6th. And we had a trans masculine group way back then. And I remember meeting you at that, but I don't remember what year it was. It was in there.
Okay. So that would have been around the time that I was co-facilitating the FTMI discussion group. And there might have been like a joint venture or it was something.
Yeah, something like that.
Excellent. Well, wonderful. We've definitely known each other and it's good to see you again. It's been a number of years since we've actually seen each other. You're working at the Bunky Clinic. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do as a medical case manager and a researcher, and then as the director of transgender surgery at the Bunky Clinic? Just give us an understanding of what that work encompasses.
Sure. The director stuff is probably the least interesting because that's administrative stuff. But as far as the complex medical case management, I do both front end and back end patient care and preparation, navigation, just general case managing in the lead up, getting people ready for surgery with us. And that could be any kind of surgery, whether it's top surgery, bottom surgery, something else altogether. We also have patients, once they are discharged from the hospital, like if they're having bottom surgery, we will keep them locally for 30 days post-op. And in that time, they have access to me pretty much 24/7 in emergencies. So people can contact me if they need to be triaged, if they're worried about something, thinking that they're having an emergency, like a medical emergency. And then I set everything into motion of whatever the next steps of care are going to be. Basically, just provide as much or as little support as each individual patient needs until their final 30th day with us. And that's pretty much it. Oh, and the research part, we have been working on a research study called Progress, which is led by a guy named Leo Rutherford at University of Victoria. There's about five of us that are all post-op phalloplasty or metoidioplasty ourselves. And then we authored the study, administrated the study, and now have completed all data collection and are working on publishing different areas of concentration off of that. So I'm primarily focused on mental health outcomes, which we unsurprisingly had incredible results showing that people who are post-op, overwhelmingly 96% have huge amount of satisfaction with their outcomes. And that is obviously contra to what the media and politicians would have you believe.
You and I both know about complications. That's one of the things that brought us back together.
Yeah.
In 2014, 2015, is we were talking about the complications we had had with our surgeries. And at the time, that was a very unpopular topic of conversation within the FTM or trans man community. It's less so now. And then there was also that time that we presented results from, I don't know if it was official research, but it was like presenting results about outcomes and just the personal experiences, statements. That was at a medical conference.
Yes.
And so I think that was the first time that the providers were hearing about these issues directly from a wide spectrum of people. Even though I've had complications, I would still measure positively on outcomes. That differentiation between just because we have complications. So I think sometimes people assume that if we have complications, that we are not happy with the outcome. Do you get that impression as well?
Yeah, I think so. And I feel like that is like a narrative, especially right now, that's being pushed pretty hard. And it's not accurate for most people that do have complications. I can't give a number on that. I think we would need to do another study. But among people that have complications with their surgeries, I would say the overwhelming amount is still satisfied, would still do it again. I know that for myself, obviously, I would love to have not had that experience, but I also would not change anything either. I'm very happy today. It changed my life 100% for the better, whether I had to go through difficulties or not.
Absolutely. You talked about the mental health piece, and two things come to mind. One, when you're talking about complications in a community at a time like when we were doing it, and it was taboo, and so it was rejected by our community. And so there's that impact. It strikes me that individuals who have anywhere from mild to moderate to severe complications, even the ones that have mild complications, if they tend to run high with anxiety, just in general, the way they respond to those complications is going to be heightened more than somebody like me that can roll with the punches a little bit better, even though I had sort of moderate level complications. So I don't know, in your case management services and in other areas at Bunky Clinic, I'm wondering if there's a way in which the baseline mental well-being of the patient is in order to gauge what level of services they might need post-op because they do run anxious or they do run depressed. And we know that some people who have depression, that when you go under general anesthesia, that can aggravate things like that. So I'm wondering, is there somebody within the clinic that's looking at those things, or is this something that is happening before they get to the clinic?
It really depends. We are largely reliant on patient self-report and also letters of surgery clearance. And now I guess I can venture into more controversial areas. And now with the overhaul of WPATH standards of care, it's really taken a lot of the teeth out of that and made it a lot more difficult to navigate, which in the end, I feel does a disservice to the patient more than anyone else. Obviously, when you and I were going through all of our surgeries, there was a different standard of care. And I think the level of stringency was pretty effective. I do think that, especially with what we're seeing, which largely correlates with people with personality disorders coming out of the woodwork and making statements against surgery, being amplified, having their voices amplified. When patients with personality disorders, especially who have been allowed to move forward with very minimal hands-on from mental health support professionals, it has led to what we see today with those voices being amplified, being able to direct conversations, especially politically. And that in the end has been a real drawback for everyone. And that I believe is a direct result of taking away a lot of the screening that's necessary for surgery. I understand from a personal perspective how difficult it is to want and need something and have to jump through a lot of hoops. But I would also say that someone, for example, needing a liver transplant would also have to jump through very similar hoops of screening and assessment. And there is no reason that any major surgery, and for most people, something like a lower surgery is going to be the most extreme surgery hopefully they will ever experience in their life, that you should not need review, assessment, support, navigation. And so without that, a lot of this in our practice will fall on me to catch things up front where people might need additional help or additional assessment or just additional support moving through.
That makes perfect sense to me. I agree. As a medical social worker, when I was working in hospital settings, I had to assess individuals that were being referred for dialysis or transplant or organ transplant, or I was also assessing people that were applying to be caregivers for our patients, which were veterans through the Department of Veterans Affairs. And so people had to go through a very thorough biopsychosocial assessment in order to figure out where were the gaps in their knowledge and what kinds of resources might they need and what kind of referrals could be made. It's perfectly logical to do that. I think about WPATH Standards of Care, let's say version 6, that was requiring people to pass through the eye of the needle, right? It was real life experience. It was basically what people refer to as gatekeeping. But then SOC 7, that was mine, that probably yours too. I consider SOC 7, Standards of Care 7, to be less strict, so to speak, more of a safekeeping than a gatekeeping. Standards of Care 8, they just threw open the gates.
Oh, yeah.
And come one, come all. And I agree. I think that's why we're seeing some of the issues we're seeing. One of the things that I think about is you said that the way that the politicians are talking about it, I think that the, let's just call it anti-trans rhetoric, right? Just to be non-precise, that's coming from, let's say, a very conservative, not little c conservative, majorly conservative side of the right. I think that's actually, it's not only, but I think part of it, and maybe a large part, is a reaction to more, let's say, extreme messages that are coming from the far left side of the community, which would include members of our community who are articulating. I think Dr. Marcy Bauer said it best when she said, there are some members of our community who think we should be able to get hormones out of vending machines. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, that's too far. I agree with that. And we've had other guests on the show talk about that same issue. Well, then how do we come at this from this nuanced perspective? This, we're from the community, and if we say such things, might we get branded transphobic? I mean, that's ridiculous, right? We're trans, we've had surgeries, we're licensed professionals, we're talking about working in medical settings. There should be some recognition of our contribution personally and professionally to the topic. I haven't found that people really go after me too much. It's been pretty mild, actually. That's because I'm not on social media. But people who are on social media, they really do get a lot of negative attention when they talk about these things. And maybe it's because they're talking about it in a way that's more charged than what we're talking about it, right? Because we're trans and we're professionals.
If I look at the state of Florida, we have some strict laws put into place now. And I think some of them are warranted, but I also think some of them are going to reach a level where it's over the top. I don't believe in incarcerating people because they're surgeons. I do believe that perhaps it should follow a typical format of scrutiny that we see in hospital settings and clinics. When there are those cases in any situation, not just transgender surgery, where maybe they're put on leave for a certain period until they can meet the standards, or they're given a grace period before they can return to a hospital setting to perform surgery. But I know a couple of surgeons who have their own surgery centers and they do whatever the hell they want. What do we do with people like that? Where do we go with that?
What I have seen is that those people are usually allowed to do whatever they want and with very little impact. And I think if they're people who are specifically working in trans populations, that is because the people monitoring them would rather that we're dead anyway, so they don't really care. There's that factor. My background is psychiatry. I came to surgery very accidentally because Babak Safa asked me to come on board this new trans surgery practice he was starting, and I was very burnt out at the time, working San Francisco DPH and not in a moderate to severe population. And I thought I would take a break for like a year. And now I've been in surgery for 8 years. And they're similarly to police with a thin blue line. There's a thin scrub line, or I don't know what you would call it. So I think that probably exists in every population. I just didn't notice it in psych in the same way. So there's that level of protection happening. If we look at those cases like Dr. Death, if either of you listened to that podcast, that guy was protected by his colleagues in neurosurgery for years and years and years before things started to shift. So I think, unfortunately, a lot of the laws in Florida have been made specifically to initiate anti-trans sentiment and potentially trans genocide. I know that's like very inflammatory language, but that's what I believe. I think that any time that you're intentionally legally dehumanizing any population, trying to strip people of access to their children, trying to strip people of access to correct documentation, that genocide is where you're going. And it might not be tomorrow, but it might be. So that is an aside, but what in that setting, I don't know what can be done for surgeons that are maybe lacking in ethics or clinical practice, because I think it is very hard to parse what is really truly not doing your job and what is witch hunting.
It's an interesting take you have on that.
Yeah, I have a lot of interesting takes.
I think what I fear, even though I can see some elements of it being necessary because of those issues with some of these surgeons and even some of the doctors who all they care about is the bottom line. It's all about the money. But I think the other piece to that, like you said, it could swing in that direction, I suppose, with just people getting all riled up. And I think that's one of the worst when we see community band together, not band together for the right purpose, but band together because they don't want to accept it perhaps, or whatever the reasons are. And that could potentially lead to some really bad outcomes.
Yeah, I agree. One of the biggest names in transgender surgery has a regular practice of performing surgery anterior lateral thigh flap on patients who are not good candidates for it, leaving them with an initial outcome of 10 to 12 inch circumference to an initial phalloplasty. So that's that. And that is unconscionable and creates a situation for people where they're like, oh, we'll deal with it in revisions. By the time that those are revised, the revision size is still going to be beyond what a normalized appearing male genitalia would be. And that is absolutely the point of this surgery. It's not to create something that makes someone more dysphoric. It's not to create something that makes someone an anomaly. It is to create a normalized appearance that is congruent with how you perceive yourself. And that is extremely poor clinical practice. We, as a practice, have had to completely redo for many people, try to revise for other people when they have been what I would consider consider victimized by this surgery group. And this group is not stopping this. They're continuing doing this. And they do it because they get money. They also don't insist on these people having hair removal. So they're doing urethroplasty with hair-bearing flap and allowing the people just to suffer when they're done. And they're raking in money and they are not going to stop. So on that level, probably bad form for me to even mention them. But as not a professional, as a member of the community, that is extremely upsetting for me to see, because it makes it very clear that for many of these practices, we are just prey and we're very easy marks because people are so desperate to be able to access care. There's another group which was just closed that the person who was the lead surgeon in that group was literally lying to patients, showing them pictures of RFF that he didn't do, and telling them that it was part of a new abdominal flap that he had created. We've redone, I think, 9 of those so far. And the fact that these patients have had to undergo that even once and experience something, I don't even have the words for it. It's terrible. And he's now been hired at another major hospital. I don't think there's a solution that I know offhand.
We are going to take our first commercial break. This is the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kay. Our guest this hour is Logan Berrien, who is a complex medical case manager, researcher, and director of transgender surgery at the Bunke Clinic in San Francisco, California. Let's take our break. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Delightful news, air travelers. Going in and out of airports without getting sick can be challenging. Time to take charge of the air you breathe with Nasal Guard. Nasal Guard topical gel defends by blocking harmful airborne particles and viruses. Try Nasal Guard for air travelers today. Visit Amazon or nasalguard.co.uk to learn more about Nasal Guard spray and gel products. Again, that's nasalguard.co.uk. UK.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, aunt and deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kegg. Our guest this hour is Logan Berrien. Let's pick up where we left off.
I don't think there's a solution that I know offhand. Professionally, I can't really speak out. No one cares what nurses have to say anyway.
Social workers would advise the patients on their rights to make a complaint to the medical board.
I think people have done that. People have filed grievances. We've encouraged filing grievances with the places that they originate at. But so then one guy is fired with all benefits, golden parachute, what have you, and just moves across the country to another place. Wow. And is employed now and operating.
The insurance industry in the past, with other types of failures in the surgical world, have stepped up and they have done something. But not everybody is an insurance case. Mm-hmm. And if they are an insurance case, I do think a little bit of this needs to fall on the insurance industry. It is just plain wrong to reimburse that surgeon when they haven't done their job.
Right. I agree.
I would imagine people are worried about if you bring too much attention to this, the insurance companies might stop covering it altogether.
Yeah.
That's probably one of those. I also wanted for the listeners, so RFF means radial forearm flap. It means that the skin is coming from the forearm to create the phalloplasty. ALT, I don't remember exactly what it stands for, but it comes from the top side of your thigh. And then with the circumference, Logan held up his hands, but only we can see that. I've heard it referred to as the circumference of a Coke can, even larger. Wow.
Coke can, like maybe after you've had some revision.
See, that's outrageous. Well, one of the things you mentioned in your bio is that you're involved in the informed consent process. It does make me wonder what kind of informed consent process is going on in those other surgery centers, because if this kind of information isn't being presented to them, or if they're, like you said, they're just so desperate, they're just gung-ho on getting the surgery, and they think, oh, it's okay, I'll get liposuction later. Part of this informed consent process, I would hope, includes going through some of the adverse effects. But I remember going through informed consent and I wasn't really gone through with me. It was just another piece of paper in a pile of papers that I signed. And so being able to actually go through, that's one of the things I appreciate with the new Florida law, is that our informed consent process is 10 to 13 pages long, depending on the type of patient, adult or minor. And it is very comprehensive. And you have to initial as you go along. You have to do it in the presence of a doctor. They have to sign off on it. It's a joint venture.
In the presence of the doctor with what type of surgery?
With trans surgeries.
Okay.
I'm just talking about hormones, actually. Just getting hormones, you have to sign this multi-page and initial with the doctor, this informed consent. That's the new Florida law.
Because I've always thought the informed consent, hinging on who was doing it, was always a worthless piece of paper. Terrible process.
That's not what Florida does anymore. Not for trans people trying to access at least hormones. I don't know what they're doing with the surgeries, but with hormones in particular, it's a very extensive process, which is similar to what I have to do every year at the VA, right? Because I get all of my hormones through the VA. I have since 2005. I have to see an endocrinologist and I have to do annual informed consent documents. That's what the Florida law is. You have to see a medical provider, you have to see them in person, and you have to do this extensive informed consent process, if not just initially, at least annually or with some sort of interval. So I don't have a problem with that. I think that's good medical care. I'm not opposed to that new law at all, because I think it's good for safekeeping of patients.
13 pages. I'm trying to picture that.
It's because it's big font and you have to initial all the way through and it doesn't crowd the page. Mm-hmm. So it's not like a 12-point font, Roman Times, paragraph after paragraph after paragraph. It's broken down and it has bullet points. And so that's why. Yeah. It's not like the old school informed consent document that looks like a legal document. Logan, you go over informed consent with the patients.
Yeah, and we have it as more of like an active process. They will meet with me initially when they're first coming in. We have an hour-long talk about what we do, what we can do for them, what we can't do for them, what they're looking for. And we really hit every point in that initial conversation. From there, we continue working on specific areas pretty closely together, myself and the patient, getting them the donor site prepared, what they need to be expecting for their recovery, what is going to be necessary with recovery, what isn't, et cetera, et cetera. And it's more of a living, breathing, informed consenting process. So by the time that they are going to meet with the surgeon and sign the documents, they've been working on this for at least a year in the lead up with me. And I feel like we do a lot to really prepare people, but I also have found very consistently that health literacy really impacts the process. So it might not matter the amount of time that you put into it. If someone doesn't have the same level of health literacy as the next person, they may not get as much out of that experience with you anyway. There are a lot of people that just want to have surgery and are willing to agree to anything. And that can be very difficult because we've carried people through to the end point and then had people be like, what do you mean I have to stay in California for 30 days for aftercare? Because we are the only practice that does that. We don't let people go early. We require you, once you're out of the hospital, to be meeting with us at minimum every week. If you need more visits, we do more visits. If you need phone coaching, you're getting that. We're just providing the safest container possible per person. And sometimes people are not maybe the most prepared, even though I've been working really hard on preparing them. And it's not their fault. It's a lot of variables that factor into that.
Yeah, I was surprised to hear you say 30 days.
Yeah, we found that it's really necessary to have at least these weekly visits over that time period because each one is building on the next and they just need to stick around for them. So it's led to us having really fantastic outcomes as far as complications go. We have the lowest complication rate in the business. We have the highest patient satisfaction rates. And that is all, I believe, really because of having a very supportive aftercare program. However, there's always more, I feel like, that we can fine tune to help people feel really supported through the process.
I know I had, and if I remember correctly, this might have been your situation as well, because we had the same surgeon. So the issue of really shoddy aftercare, I mean, just terrible. So you're highly attuned to this need for this aftercare. And I'm very happy to hear that you have that. I mean, it's going to be difficult for people who are self-pay, but for people who have insurance coverage, typically they can negotiate that the insurance company reimburses or foots the bill for a big chunk, if not all of that, lodging and per diem and transportation and travel, things like that. A lot of people don't know that, but they need to just talk to somebody beyond the front line to see what's available to them if they're being sent out of network or to a place that's with a certain number of miles away from their home. A lot of the insurances can cover those kinds of things. So,
interesting. I've only seen Kaiser cover anything, and they're very, very generous about it. And I hope that continues. I don't feel well. Every other of the big carriers that we work with are very resistant. I wish they weren't. But Kaiser has made a great example of how they're really good at this part for gender-affirming care.
I'm glad to hear that they're still sending people out because I know Kaiser has developed their own trans surgery programs. So
I don't even know what's happening with that.
A lot of people don't even know what health literacy is. And as a social worker, I learned about health literacy so that I could talk to patients and clients and put things into terms that they would understand them. There is a really wonderful website called Health Literacy Lab, where you can go and learn all kinds of really interesting information. I've done some trainings within the social work profession at social work conferences, and I cover a piece on health literacy. And I give an example that comes from the Health Literacy Lab, which is that the word transgender, just that word, is based on health literacy. That word is considered to be about maybe the second or third year of college level of understanding the concept of,
right.
Because it's not a regularly used everyday word, right? So you have to get exposure to things, people, books, classes where you're learning about this. And so just that very word is outside of the range of most people when you think that if it's still true that the average person reads at the, eighth grade level?
Yeah.
Right. So a college level word is going to be far outside of that. So the ability to explain to people, which means you take the time. It sounds like that's what you're doing. You're taking your time with people. But as you said, even when you go through that extensive intake and orientation process, you still have people come out at the end and say, what do you mean I have to stay in town for 30 days? Because there's just also the ability to retain information. That's going to be different for each person. And also, if we're thinking our thoughts while somebody's talking to us, we're not really taking it in. We have to tell them, and then we have to give it to them in writing, and then we have to quiz them. Get you to say it back to me.
Yeah.
Where did you get the eighth grade level? Because I've always heard it's sixth grade.
Oh, maybe it is sixth grade.
I think it's sixth grade.
Oh, gosh. I guess I was remembering correctly. when USA Today was first launched, and they said that it was at the, I thought it was eighth grade, so maybe the sixth grade reading level, because that was the base, that was like the predominant reading level across the United States. And so that newspaper, they were saying, we're readable, not like those Wall Street Journal or New York Times newspapers that are unreadable by a majority of people.
Right.
So sixth grade is even lower. So a college level word is completely outside the comprehension of somebody who's coming in for a surgery. We don't really think that about people. That might be one of those ugly class things that people don't like to talk about, that if you don't comprehend words beyond the sixth grade, it's because you're poor, or it doesn't necessarily mean that. It just means that it could be a lot of reasons. It's like you said, when you don't have the level of screening that used to take place, people are going to be able to access surgeries who just don't have a comprehension of what they're signing on for.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Ahn has written and published a paper in a journal, an academic journal, about informed consent. So is very much a champion for informed consent. I, too, as a social worker, informed consent was my bread and butter, really. And we've had a panel once with three individuals, and we focused on informed consent to talk more about that, because it's comes up a lot. When I hear individuals who refer to themselves as like de-sisters or de-transitioners in particular, they'll mention things like they didn't have good informed consent. They went to a clinic where they had one 20-minute visit in person, or maybe just on their telephone, a video appointment after 20 minutes, and they were mailed a prescription and it arrived at their doorstep, or they were called at from the pharmacy to come pick it up. That's like a major complaint that I hear pretty often.
Yeah, definitely. I've seen and heard that. I do think it's very difficult to navigate that space. And I have a hard time with all of this. I'm a libertarian, like a true libertarian, not a conservative Christian libertarian. So on many levels, I feel like to the government to say what I can do or anyone else can do. And then at the same time, as a medical professional, I feel very differently about that. And we have a role that we need to play in helping people to make the choices that are going to be best for them. On one level, like, there does need to be some level of agency and personal responsibility that everyone has. That's, you did make the choice to go to this place. But I also think that the push and the standards of care 8, the infiltration to the organization of people who are overwhelmingly not wanting to have any kind of safety net in place and any kind of framework to actually make good diagnoses, that all contributes to people feeling detransition is their right direction, or maybe they never should have tried in the first place. And I think that's also another very nuanced thing, where lack of social support and lack of familial support and religious persecution and all of these things play a huge role as well. But not having anything to be a barrier between you and a decision that is pretty gigantic is not ideal either.
Like everything you've said so far, and we have to have a calling to reduce as much harm to people as possible. And I think the medical world, including the surgical world, can be thoughtless sometimes. And I have truly a concern about that.
And it doesn't matter if it's a facelift, if it's lip fillers, if it's breast implants, if it's a breast reduction, if it's guys going for pec implants, all of it is gender affirming. And all of it is completely in that sense, regardless as to like whether it's the gender that you were assigned at birth or not. You want that to feel affirmed, and it doesn't make it more right or more wrong whether you are cisgender and seeking gender affirming surgery to affirm your cisness, or whether you're trans. And I wish that we could change those narratives, especially in society at large. And I think it would also really change the way things are done in the plastic surgery industry overall as well. Because like you said, there's no conversation. It's kind of like, if you got the money, you're getting it. It's not necessarily always ideal, as you've experienced.
We will be taking our second commercial break. This is Dr. On with Xander Kagg, and our guest this hour is Logan Berrien. Logan Berrien is a complex medical case manager, researcher, and director of transgender surgery at the Bunke Clinic in San Francisco. He has been serving the community as a trainer of other medical providers in trans competent care, aiding countless patients with the informed consent and navigation through the gender-affirming surgery process, also known by its acronym GAS, and co-authoring, data collecting, and publishing groundbreaking patient-centered research on outcomes in phalloplasty and metoidioplasty in transmasculine communities. Let's take our break. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one supplement brand, help you put back what life takes out. All-in-one comprehensive formulas created to offer you maximum benefit, whatever stage of life you're at, and with a range that supports everything from immunity, energy, cardiovascular health, joints, cognitive function, menopause, and even beauty. We've got you and your family covered. Premium ingredients packed into a powerful daily sachet. Simply mix with water to activate for a flavorful health drink. Perfect at home or on the go. Revive Active. Available at selected Holland & Barrett stores, Well Pharmacies, and online at Amazon and reviveactive.com. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg. And our guest this hour is Logan Berrien. Let's pick up where we left off.
Yeah, we had a recent guest on, Merle Yost, who was talking about gynecomastia. We didn't use the language of gender-affirming surgery, but oftentimes if those men are going to go forward with surgery, it's because they have an idealized version of how their chest should look, or they're taking their cues from societal expectations, you know, images they see in the media, things like that. It's very interesting to look at it in that, from that perspective. We haven't actually used these words, but we've been talking about, as part of the work that you do, part of the work that I used to do when I was with the transgender care team with the Navy Medicine West Department, it's talking about preparedness and readiness. Are people prepared for their surgery? Are they ready? I would ask people, who's going to pick you up from the hospital? What do you mean? Well, you can't just jump in a cab.
Right.
Somebody has to come pick you up. And they're like, but I'm traveling alone. Oh, you're going to come all the way to the state of California and spend 2, 3, 4 weeks here and nobody's coming with you? Absolutely not. Somebody has to pick you up and be with you at least the first 24 hours. And then for these more complex surgeries like phalloplasty, they really need to be with you. People have no idea. Even after top surgery, you can't use your arms for like 2 weeks, for gosh sake. Like you need people around to like open the cabinets and get a cup out for you, unless you have good people in your community who tell you, pull everything out of your cupboards and put them on the counter, you know, so that you're ready. So it's like this preparedness, this readiness for, Are you mentally and emotionally ready? Are you prepared? Do you have all of the things at your home that you will need post-op that you can get ahead of time? Because you can get lists of these things when you go to your pre-op appointment, the one that's in the office, not the one in the day of surgery. But I think a lot of times this is also the kind of information that can kind of go in one ear and out the other with people. Yeah. And then all of a sudden they find themselves back in the hotel room or the Airbnb or their home. Why am I having so much trouble making bowel movements? Oh, maybe I should have gotten all that medication that the doctor told me about because I'm on painkillers. And so that's right. Disrupting my bowel movements. And that might be why you're having a total panic attack on the toilet.
Right.
Because you think you're going to rip all your stitches out. Yeah. I'm talking about personal experience here. I had all the medications that I was told to have. It doesn't necessarily matter.
Right.
Painkillers do what painkillers do to your gut. Right. And it's not pretty.
No, at all.
Yeah. I'm glad that you're spending good time with people and you're doing your level of assessment. It's probably true that people are getting to you who should have had. There should have been a bit more assessment of preparedness and readiness before they even got to you. But you're doing what you can at your level.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we have had very unexpected, difficult situations where the people doing the assessment of a patient have lied and approved them, not out of malice, out of empathy, but it's misplaced empathy. Don't approve someone that doesn't actually have a place to live because that's not a situation that is safe for them on any level. Very early on, had these experiences, and they haven't happened in quite a while, but at the time, it resulted in scrambling, having to get people into respite care in San Francisco, which is not where you should be recovering from this surgery at respite. And now medical respite will no longer take these cases because they just don't work there. And I think that for the most part, we have, at least within the Bay Area, educated providers who are letter writers and mental health assessment people from doing that for the most part. But there are some places still that will approve people who are maybe not the best candidate at that time. And that patient selection piece is so, so important. Because if you move forward with the surgery with someone who is not in the right place, it could just be a medical disaster, a personal disaster, and that's hard to recover from.
Yeah, that's too bad about the medical respite. I remember sitting down on a couple of occasions with Julie Graham when she was building up the San Francisco Public Health Department's trans care services. And we were talking through what are all the resources and services that would be good for this population of people who were on Medicaid and even other kinds of healthcare. And it was like, oh, medical respite was one of those things. And so a lot of their patients used to use that. So it's a bummer to hear that's become a problem now. I like this tension between your libertarian self and your health provider self, because that's very interesting. I would imagine that that's something that many people can relate to. And I think that's where some of these people who are getting letters without full assessment, I think it's because the message that's getting out there is, we know who we are. Just right. Let us have what we say we want and need, because we've labeled it life-saving, medically necessary as a way to get the insurance companies to pay for it. And so now the next line of thinking is, we know who we are, so just write us the darn letter and get out of our way. And so we know where it comes from, but when you work on the healthcare side of things, because you're skipping over some of these other parts,
right,
you're going to have unnecessary negative, not necessarily physical outcomes, but maybe mental or emotional outcomes, yeah, because you're not prepared. I always say to people, phalloplasty is not for the weak-minded or the hypersensitive. It is a grueling process to go through. And so people have to have strong resiliency in order to withstand how difficult it can be in many, many different ways that you might not even realize until you're right in the middle of it. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of assessment for drug and alcohol abuse for people going through surgeries. And so they'll be self-medicating. They'll go right back to smoking cigarettes or using drugs or alcohol. And that's going to definitely impact their healing. They'll lie and say, oh, no, I'm not smoking. I quit smoking. Right. In the Navy, we used to blood test people the morning of surgery. And if they pop positive for nicotine, we canceled it because we know that the nicotine inhibits good healing. Yeah. You know,
we've had to have those morning of cancellations, too. And it's always very, very unfortunate. I think a lot of people have been pretty good with that. The last one that we had to cancel like that was quite a while ago. So that at least is getting out there. And there's a lot of options. Like if someone asks us for help with quitting smoking, like we can prescribe things for them to have help with quitting smoking. Same thing if someone's a frequent cannabis user, I just tell them, well, don't stop cannabis, just switch to edibles and we'll tell you when you can switch back. And most people are willing to do that because it's not the cannabis, it's the product of combustion that is your enemy. There's a way around it. Maybe if you're doing edibles, you're going to need less of narcotics in your healing and you're going to have less problems with constipation. So I like things like that. It's harder when people are more of a stimulant abuser, but usually that's something that we can head off to and help divert someone to treatment if that's what they want at that time. And if they don't, then revisit it when they're more ready to do that. Because similarly, anything that's going to be affecting the vascular system is just an enemy of this surgery.
Yeah. And these are the kinds of things that just the average person isn't thinking about.
Right.
Right. They're just not. So the trans person, their friends, their family members, right, these are not the things they're thinking about, which is why I'm a strong supporter of the biopsychosocial assessment as a baseline for anybody going forward with surgeries. Well, Logan, this has been a very informative and very interesting discussion. I'm so glad that we were able to have you on the show today.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate you guys having me on. It was a lot of fun. Definitely down to talk about the libertarian medical thing anytime.
Absolutely. Now, the Bunky Clinic, how do people find out more about the Bunky Clinic?
You can find us at www.bunky.org. We have another site that is SFTI, San Francisco Transgender Institute, also .org, and BUNCKE.org. And I can be reached at Logan, LOGAN, at BUNCKE.org.
Thank you, Logan. And the other one was SFTI.org.
Yes.
Perfect.
I enjoyed the interview.
Yes, me too. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good day.
You have been listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg, and our guest this hour was Logan Berrien. We hope that you enjoyed this segment and that you found it to be informative and helpful. Thank you for listening to the Umbrella Hour.